Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. Hoo-wah! I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Thanks for joining us. Hey, I love Mark Twain. Here's one of his quotes, and it's quite true. Courage is the resistance to fear, mastery of fear, not the absence of fear. I can say that's true. Joining me at the 50 caliber microphone today is Marine Vet Skip Coriel. So what have you been up to, Skip? I haven't heard from you in a week.
Well, I've been doing all kinds of things. I'm getting ready to take out some groundhogs. We're going scorch earth this year. But, you know, let's get back to Mark Twain. He's one of my favorite authors. He also said, the more I learn about people, the more I like my dog.
You know, and he spoke the truth there too, huh?
Yes.
Here's what we have for you today. On News and Comics by the Colonel, I'm going to discuss several historical items that we should keep in mind about the Ukraine war. Then Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby will contribute his warrant wisdom. Then veteran Sean Sorby will discuss Veterans for Smart Power. Next, Israeli Defense Force Reserve Major Elliot Chodoff will discuss what's going on in Israel. And Valerie Leffler from Phoenix will share how they provide rides for veterans.
Hey, troops, please invite your friends to join us at this time on this great radio station. Then head on out to frontlinesoffreedom.com and sign up for our free e-newsletter. And join the conversation at facebook.com/frontlinesoffreedom.
We welcome your input to the show. Send us your ideas and comments through our website, frontlinesoffreedom.com, or by Facebook. Well, first, my comments about the war in Ukraine. Ukraine won't attack to take back Donbass and Crimea in the short term, President Zelensky said recently. Donbass and Crimea are two regions of Ukraine in which live people of Russian descent, some of whom want to be part of Russia. Russia annexed Crimea in 2014, and the conflict in Donbass between Ukrainian military and Russian-backed separatists escalated into a war the same year. Both areas have been de facto occupied by Russia or separatists. Donbass is the industrial heartland of Ukraine. Ukrainian military could lose lots of soldiers in trying to take back Donbass and Crimea, which Zelensky called temporarily occupied territories. Taking back control of the city of Mariupol, which was taken by Russia on February 24th, is also very difficult, he said. Zelensky made the remarks as the Russian armed forces withdrew from the outskirts of Kyiv after trying to occupy the Ukrainian capital and shifting to the disputed territories in eastern Ukraine. The Kremlin said earlier that Donbass is the main goal of the invasion. Zelensky acknowledged that the intention of Russia's military operation is to occupy the corridor connecting Crimea and Donbass, with Mariupol being a key city along the corridor. The UN said that as of April 4th, 1,430 civilians have been killed and 2,097 injured in Ukraine since Russia's invasion, and over 4.2 million people have fled Ukraine. And now, for more news on the war in Ukraine and other news, here's co-host Skip Coriel. Take it away, Skip.
Talks to stop the fighting in Ukraine resumed as another attempt to rescue civilians from the besieged port city of Mariupol broke down, and Russia accused the Ukrainians of launching a cross-border helicopter attack on an oil depot. The governor of Russia's Belgorod region said the alleged airstrike by a pair of helicopter gunships caused multiple fires and injured two people. A Kremlin spokesman said the incident on Russia's territory could undermine the negotiations between Russian and Ukrainian representatives. Quote, certainly this is not something that can be perceived as creating comfortable conditions for the continuation of the talks, Kremlin spokesman Peskov replied when asked if the strike could be viewed as an escalation of the war in Ukraine.
So Russia attacking Ukraine and targeting civilians and destroying the infrastructure is okay, but Ukraine hitting back at Russia is somehow an escalation? The only real question is, why hasn't Ukraine done this sooner? I wonder how long the Russian people are going to put up with their evil leadership.
Ukrainian forces continue to capture, or at least stumble across, examples of some of Russia's most sophisticated ground combat hardware as the conflict in the country rages on. Late last month, pictures emerged online showing a Russian radar-equipped Air Defense Command post vehicle, part of a larger system known as Barnaul-T, that Ukrainian troops found during a counteroffensive in the northeastern Kharkiv region. The fact that this vehicle is intended to serve as a sensor, command and control, and communications node, all rolled into one, could make it a particularly invaluable source of intelligence for Ukrainian and foreign governments, as well as be a significant operational loss for Russian forces. A Ukrainian unit reportedly found this vehicle relatively intact among other Russian vehicles and artillery pieces in the town of Huskarivka.
Russian military leadership is very clearly weak, or maybe the Russian soldiers no longer wish to attack a neighboring country for no valid reason.
Russian forces are targeting Ukraine's weapons factories, hoping to chip away at Kiev's ability to repair damaged vehicles and equip its army. But when it comes to armored vehicles, at least, attacking factories might not make much of a difference. The Ukrainians already are finding ways of fixing battle-damaged vehicles without sending them to big, easy-to-target factories. It's worth asking what it takes to repair a tank. First and foremost, you need cranes and hoists in order to shift immobile tanks and remove their turrets. After that, you need welders, mechanics, electricians, bending metal, rewiring and replacing automotive components and replacing treads, reactive armor blocks, radios and machine guns isn't necessarily precision work requiring a big facility. Fixing ballistic computers and optics might require a little more finesse, but for simpler repairs, fixing a tank is like fixing a truck, but on steroids. One Ukrainian soldier oversees a junkyard where workers strip and rebuild captured vehicles. Quote, "Everything that we take away from the Russian army, we transfer to the armed forces of Ukraine. The Kiev sites might lack the cranes they need to remove the 12-ton turret from a 40-ton T-64, but there are plenty of small industrial facilities that do have cranes. Ukraine's big tank factory might be in ruins, but that doesn't mean Ukraine can't fix its tanks."
Way to go, Ukraine. People fighting for their own freedom and their nation can be very creative, and the invaders pay the price.
The army admitted it was having problems recruiting and announced an unprecedented reduction in its numbers that would shrink the active duty army to its smallest size since World War II. Quote, "We're facing, obviously, some challenging conditions in terms of our ability to recruit and attract talent," Undersecretary of the Army Gabe Camarillo said. Quote, "What we're just seeing is, given the particular conditions of a very tight labor market, our ability to meet all of our projected recruiting goals, we're a little bit challenged in fiscal year 2022 and fiscal year 23. Camarillo said the Army's end strength, or total number of forces, would go from 485,000 soldiers currently to 476,000 in fiscal year 2022, which ends in September, and further down to 473,000 in fiscal year 2023. He said the Army decided on reducing its recruitment goals instead of lowering standards. He added that the Army hoped to build back its numbers over the next 5 years.
Hey, this is not surprising. The senior leadership in our military, including the Army, is so poor now that virtually no veterans I know will recommend joining to any youth. A woke military makes no sense at all. Listen to the next news item.
As the Virginia Military Institute continues to march toward the implementation of diversity, equity, and inclusion programming on campus, a battalion of its alumni have launched something of a blitzkrieg against those plans. A large and vocal company of alumni, cadets, parents, and friends of VMI recently started a petition calling on Virginia Attorney General Meares to halt any and all DEI initiatives until a full investigation is performed. Concerned VMI supporters have also taken to local media outlets, lambasting the plans. They're also calling on newly elected Republican Governor Youngkin, who has already curbed DEI programming in public K-12 schools, to take the same tactic with higher education.
There is nothing about critical race theory, sometimes called diversity, equity, and inclusion, that makes any group better. It's very divisive. And when it's important, nobody uses it. Look at any NFL team and talk to me about diversity, equality, and inclusion. What they're interested in is logically ability. And that's what our military needs. And that's the news. Americans, it's our responsibility to ensure that our nation is well-run and on the right path. Politics and politicians are confusing, but we can work together. Concerned Veterans for America can assist you in getting involved and getting our nation back on track. Working with them is one of the things I do personally. Check cv4a.org. That's cv4a.org. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. Coming up on Frontlines of Freedom, I'll share comments by the Colonel and we'll enjoy some warrant wisdom. Then we'll talk smart power with Sean Corby. At ease, troops, take a break. Day 3 Creation is a Christian family-owned provider of American-made, non-intoxicating, non-addictive CBD products. Our Get Relief, Give Relief program sees that 10% of all profits go to Patriot Paws, providing service dogs at no cost to disabled veterans to help restore their physical and emotional independence. Giving is an expression of our thankfulness and praise to God as we recognize that everything we have belongs to the Lord. Visit day3creation.com to learn more. God bless.
This is Marine Vet Skip Coriel with your Home Defense Tip of the Week. According to the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, 80% of rape victims knew their attacker. Be careful who you let into your life. If they don't feel right to you, then don't associate with them. My experience has taught me this. When you let crazy people into your life gets crazy. This is just one more way to keep your family safe. For more useful tips on home and personal defense, visit homedefenseshow.com.
This is Lieutenant Colonel retired John Barry, managing partner of Barry Law. For over 50 years, Barry Law has defended the rights of Americans, both on the battlefield and in the courtroom. We are committed to supporting our fellow service members. If you need help appealing your VA disability decision, find us at PTSDlawyers.com or call 888-883-2483.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum. It's 20 minutes after the hour, and you're in formation and listening to the Frontlines of Freedom all across America. Troops, did you know that American farmers are going out of business because folks are buying foreign food? It's not good for our nation's security if we can't feed ourselves. We need to maintain our food independence by buying food grown in America. Patriot Foods is not emergency food. It's food produced by our farmers, and it's good. I love it. Check patriotfoods.com. That's patriotfoods.com. Now it's time for comments by the Colonel. As we observe the war in Ukraine and develop ideas about how we might help the good guys win, there are several historical references that we should keep in mind. The first is no-fly zones. Lots of folks are calling for NATO to establish a no-fly zone above Ukraine to stop Russian bombing of Ukrainian cities. That isn't a good idea or even a viable one. Russian planes can still launch missiles from the nearby airspace of both Russia and Belarus. No nation in history has declared a no-fly zone against an adversarial nuclear power, and for good reason. No-fly zones are best known from the 12-year air block over Iraq between the two Gulf Wars. NATO also imposed a no-fly zone over Bosnia and Herzegovina in the 1990s and again in Libya in 2011. These efforts were aimed respectively at the bloody, though small-time dictators Saddam Hussein, Slobodan Milosevic, and Muammar Gaddafi. None were major powers or had nuclear weapons. Eventually, the air patrols withered away. Often, allies bickered about their relative contributions. Sometimes the zones fail to stop ongoing anarchy on the ground. Enemies often still used low-flying ground assault helicopters. We never attempted no-fly zone against either nuclear Russia or China during the Cold War, despite a long history of these countries supplying wartime enemies of ours, like in Korea and Vietnam. The risk of a nuclear war must be taken seriously, and Russian President Putin is certainly capable of starting one. Next, regime change. There's been a lot of wild talk from our president and others about removing or assassinating Putin to achieve a regime change in Russia. Here, too, our nation has a mixed record at best, from the engineered ouster of Vietnam's President Diem to Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. Efforts to kill Cuban President Fidel Castro boomerangs in ways that are still, I guess, classified. I remember all of these attempts. In the past, we have caused the removal of dozens of unfriendly heads of state in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Often the change didn't achieve the objectives that were in our long-term interest, much less did they achieve stability in the region. Such coups and hit jobs did, however, tarnish our claim to the moral high ground. Now, do evil dictators really hijack power from oppressed societies, or are they merely the logical consequence of them? Before Putin, were there democratically elected czars, Soviet premiers, or post-Cold War Russian strongmen? Nope. Once Western liberals run their mouths about removing heads of state, such dictators will, reasonably, do the same thing. Why wouldn't they? Do we really want Putin threatening Western presidents, giving the record of his former political enemies to disappear? Third, nation building. Western powers, for a time, can nation build abroad. But recreating nations in our image requires terrible cost in blood and treasure, if it's even possible. Even the idealists are branded as neo-colonialists and imperialists. Even the beneficiaries of liberal democracy feel like it was imposed, and any gratitude and warm feelings towards America is short-lived. And who are we to force our style of government on others? And Americans, meanwhile, complain that trillions of dollars spent abroad could be better spent at home. Witness the recently failed 20-year mess in Afghanistan. Fourth, moral hysteria. Our nation does not have a good record of turning wars into moral crusades by branding our allies divine and our enemies satanic. We were wrong to have banned German language instruction during World War I. We should have never put Japanese legal residents and patriotic Japanese Americans in detention camps during World War II. For years, we've seen goofy caricatures of Russians as subhuman thugs, from crudely stereotyped, tattooed, shaved-headed villains in Hollywood movies to the Russian Alpha Banks hoax and the Hunter Biden laptop Russian disinformation hoax. Ukraine President Zelensky has shown himself a gifted and courageous leader who, logically, we should support and supply. But he's not an archangel pitted against evil Russian 18-year-old conscripts or necessarily the moral superior of Russian tourists. Millions of impoverished Russians had no say about Putin's savage misadventure in Ukraine. That Ukraine is morally in the right, certainly deserves Western help, does not mean that all Russians should be demonized or that a corrupt Ukrainian government that just suspended its opposition parties should be deified. Fifth, the Russian military abroad. The Russian army is historically unbeatable on its home soil. Napoleon Bonaparte and Adolf Hitler both wrecked their once indomitable militaries once they crossed into Russia. But the expeditionary armies of multi-ethnic Russia have never done well abroad in foreign invasions and against determined enemies. Moscow faced a series of embarrassing and utter defeats in the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-05. The Tsar's 1914 invasion of East Prussia ended in catastrophe. Russia invaded Poland and lost the Polish War of 1919-1921. Stalin's attack against tiny Finland in 1939 turned into a bloody quagmire. And the decade-long invasion and occupation of Afghanistan ended in defeat. Given these past realities, Ukraine can defeat Putin's expeditionary army if we and our NATO allies and other nations will increase aid, do not embrace no-fly zones or other provocative trajectories to World War III, cease crazy talk of killing or removing Putin, stop whipping up hatred of all things Russian, and remember that history was never on Putin's side when he invaded Ukraine. And those are my comments for today. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. You're listening to Frontlines of Freedom, and now we get to enjoy some warrant wisdom with Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby. What do you have this week, Roland?
Well, Colonel, I'm down in Florida this weekend to attend the Sun and Fun Aerospace Expo, or what the rest of the world calls an air show. And as luck would have it, the U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds are flying here this weekend. This got me thinking, which is usually not a great thing. How and why does the military have the Thunderbirds and the Blue Angels? You see, it all started back in 1946 when naval pilots were returning from World War II. The Navy started the Blue Angels partly for recruiting future pilots, partly for raising unit morale, and partly to gain the support of Congress members who vote on military budgets. The U.S. Air Force followed suit in 1953 when the Thunderbirds began doing air shows for the public. It hasn't been all roses for the teams, as both the Navy and the Air Force have had serious contamination issues at their bases. In fact, the base where the Blue Angels are headquartered is on the EPA's highest priority list, likely due to JP5 contamination, which is really some pretty nasty fuel. Then there were reports of the Blue Angels petrochemically poisoning the Gulf of Mexico when the Navy decided to have all of its jets dump their excess fuel over the Gulf of Mexico just prior to landing to decrease the very remote possibility, and I mean very remote possibility, of a lethal fireball in case of a crash landing. The Navy, for the most part, has stopped doing that many years ago, but not because it was bad for the environment, but instead because of the increase in fuel prices. No one really knows the actual amount of fuel that's been dumped over the years. So what does it cost for the Blues or the Thunderbirds to put on an air show? Well, fuel consumption data is pretty much kept secret, and probably for a good reason. However, it's been reported that an F-18 will burn about 1,200 gallons an hour. The fuel they use, the JP-5, costs the military about $10 per gallon. So that's $12,000 per hour just for fuel. So if you multiply that by six planes that fly in the air show, that's $72,000 per hour. And generally, each team does about 35 air shows a year with 2 days of doing performances and 1 day of practice at each location. So that's 105 performances per year at a cost of about $7.5 million just in fuel alone. This doesn't account for the fuel cost to get to each air show or the nearly 1,300 hours of practice during the off-season. Now, I'm not saying these numbers are correct, but even if they're off by half, it's still costing the U.S. taxpayers a ton of money for these teams to exist. However, I will argue, I think it's worth every single penny. For Frontlines of Freedom, I'm Chief Warrant Officer Roland Ashby. Back to you, Colonel.
Thanks, Roland. Straight ahead on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll talk with veteran Sean Sorby about Veterans for Smart Power. Then we'll talk with Israeli Major Elliot Chodoff. All this is coming up. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. You're standing tall with Frontlines of Freedom. I'll be right back. Troops, it's time for pull-ups. Start with 40, take a break, do another 30, then stand at ease. Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to vetted veterans programs, mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code.
From ending our nation's endless wars, to making sure veterans get the care they deserve, to addressing our country's out-of-control spending problem, Concerned Veterans for America is taking on the most important issues facing our nation. You can help CVA shape a better future for Americans everywhere. Visit cv4a.org to learn more, see how you can get involved, and join our movement. That's cv4a.org.
Do you have a story inside you yearning to come out? As a self-published author, you are free to creatively distribute your book online or using your own professional connections. White Feather Press will publish your manuscript and set up online distribution, allowing the author to retain all copyright and distribution rights as well as all profits. Check out White Feather Press at publishyourdream.com. White Feather Press, reaffirming faith in God, family, and country. Troops, welcome back to our nation's largest military veteran talk radio show, Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Troops, please do send me your comments and questions. Email me through frontlinesoffreedom.com. It's an honor to welcome to the show veteran Sean Sorby. Sean's the director of veteran outreach at the Veterans for Smart Power. And if there's ever anything that our nation needs to be focused on right now, it's power. So welcome. Glad you could join us.
Thanks so much, Denny. Really appreciate you having me on the show today. And let me just say, I'm a fan of yours. I'm a fan of the show. And I really just appreciate the platform that you provide for veterans of all different stripes to come on and, you know, present their viewpoints and talk about some things that maybe all vets don't either get exposed to or folks don't hear from them. So really just appreciate what you do.
Well, you know, our goal is not to tell people what to think, but to help them know what's out there and draw their own conclusions. So let's do that. Sean, start by telling us about your time in the military. When and why did you join? What'd you do?
Well, let's see. I grew up in the Tampa Bay area of Florida, which I know you're familiar with. And I watched the Twin Towers come down on TV when I was in my junior year of high school. I was in Navy ROTC at the time. And, I think like a lot of us, that had a really big impact on me. So a couple of years later in 2004, after I was out of high school, I enlisted in the Marines. I was a contract infantry guy. And, then when I was in recruit training, I actually got selected to go to Marine Barracks 8th and I in Washington, D.C., which is, you know, one of the ceremonial units, the honor guard.
Yeah.
And, much to my mother was very pleased that that's actually where I spent the duration of my enlistment. It was all 4 years at the barracks. And a lot of that was marching in the parades that the barracks has on Friday nights or ceremonies all over the National Capital Region. But of course, the big part of what I did was marching in funerals at Arlington National Cemetery. And that was, one of the great honors of my life. And wouldn't change it for anything. And everything that's happened to me since then has been a result of my military service. So I'm really proud of it.
Well, you know, the folks stationed like you were in D.C., it's mostly ceremonial, but if anything goes wrong, they've got a mission that's far more than ceremonial. So therefore, I know what you're talking about. Okay. Tell us about Veterans for Smart Power. How did you hear about it and what got you to join them?
So Veterans for Smart Power is a subgroup, a sub-project of the U.S. Global Leadership Coalition. And the U.S. Global Leadership Coalition, what we are is a national, nonpartisan, bipartisan, however you want to say it. We're a nonprofit organization that raises awareness about and educates the public and lawmakers about America's civilian-led tools of development and diplomacy. And the viewpoint that we take is that these programs are really essential to our economic well-being. They're in keeping with our humanitarian values as a people, and they're absolutely essential to our national security. So our organization has a national advisory council that's comprised of every living former Secretary of State from Kissinger to Kerry, and a host of other national figures on there that you'd recognize. We have a national security advisory council of over 200 retired 3- and 4-star general and flag officers. And then we have a national coalition that's comprised of over 500 corporations and NGOs, everything from Walmart to CARE to Boeing to Johnson & Johnson, Coca-Cola, UPS, and then, you know, even things like the World Wildlife Fund and Catholic Relief Services and Save the Children. So it's a really, really diverse group of organizations. And then myself, along with my colleague, Gretchen Klingler, we oversee that Veterans for Smart Power program, which, you know, while our National Security Advisory Council is all 3- and 4-stars, Veterans for Smart Power is literally everybody else, from private to 2-star. These are folks who really cut across the depth and breadth of military service. Those who served, you know, just 4 years in peacetime, all the way up to those who did 40 years across just about every theater of operations you can imagine, from the Korean War on to the conflicts that are going on today. And a lot of them have served alongside state or USAID professionals, whether that be forward deployed or at the various combatant commands, at the Pentagon, you name it. And they understand the value that development and diplomacy brings to our national security. And that really, the State Department, USAID, and the Department of Defense really work hand in hand on a day-to-day basis to go out there and execute on our national security strategy. It's really all part and parcel to the same thing. So, you know, the way that I got involved was, you know, after I got out of the military, it was 2008 was my last year. The post 9/11 GI Bill was coming around. I decided I wanted to go to college. So I went back home to Florida. I went to the University of South Florida and got my political science degree. And while I was there, it's just where I started to learn a little bit more about how the world works and, you know, what are some of the drivers of things like violent extremism around the world? And why is America involved in a lot of the places we are around the globe for different reasons? And you start to learn about, you know, the government and some of the tools that we have, and that we have these foreign policy tools in our toolbox that can go out and look 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the line at what are these places around the world that can be hotspots? What's going to flare up and be the thing that's at risk to our security and our security interests around the world? And that we have these strategic investments in things like global development and our diplomatic apparatus and working with our allies that can help mitigate those threats and keep those problems small and far away. And really, it's a tiny investment. 1% or less of the federal budget goes towards all of our foreign spending that's not DOD or intelligence. And so I think that the return on investment is huge if we don't have to send our brothers and sisters in arms into harm's way. And we can prevent those conflicts from happening, that's absolutely something that we should be invested in. And so when I learned that there's this organization called USGLC and Veterans for Smart Power, that's what they stand for, that was something that I really wanted to be a part of. So it's been an honor of mine to travel around the country these past 5 years, meet lots of veterans who are way more badass than I ever was, and introduce them to their members of Congress and give them a platform to talk about their foreign policy experience and their experience with these issues that most people really don't know a lot about. And it's a great thing. And I encourage folks to check out usglc.org and they can learn more or send me a note right at Sean Sorby. It's ssorby@usglc.org is my email address.
Well, that's amazing, because one of the things that we don't have any short of in our country right now is people who know exactly how everybody should be doing and thinks anybody who's doing it any other way is stupid. and getting groups of people with background from different backgrounds and different perspectives, that's diversity at its best. And it's amazing that you can come up with things that'll work for people that will plug into that. It's not selling anything. It's helping you get more facts before you make up your own mind. Is that a safe statement?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's what we try to do, is operate as a resource for people to learn things that they might not otherwise learn. Because let's face it, you know, like I said, these issues are funded by 1% of our federal budget. So I like to say that people generally will give you about 1% of their time to talk about it. And people are concerned with lots of other things. So we understand, but there's a lot of misconceptions out there about what America is doing around the world. There's a lot of misconceptions about foreign aid. People think that we spend a lot more money on this stuff than we really do. I think if you poll the average American, they think that we spend 25 cents on every dollar in foreign programs. And they kind of view that as us just giving stacks of cash away to foreign governments, which is not it at all. It's not even close to that number. But the irony is, if you ask people how much they think we ought to be spending on foreign aid programs, they'll say 10%. So it's actually 10 times as much as we actually do. So that's the gulf of that we're trying to bridge here between what people think and what is the reality. And the way that we carry this out is through educational programming that's public facing. And, you know, we will meet with any federal candidate for office who will take a meeting with us, so that we can provide them with this information before they, you know, maybe develop some foreign policy views that are calcified, maybe a little misinformed, that they then can't walk away from later. So we act as a resource for those folks, for people in just the everyday public, and for members of Congress.
There's more to discuss about this and energy, and Sean's going to stay with us. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom Troops. It's push-up time. I want you to do 103 push-ups. That's how many I do, well, most days. Then take a break, but stay in the area. Sean and I will be right back. My fellow patriots, in these troubling times, it is more important than ever for us to take care of our fellow Americans. That's what Patriot Food stands for, U.S. only grown foods. When you make an online purchase, you are supporting a U.S. farmer and our great veterans every time. Don't mistake Patriot Foods for survival food. This is an American farmer brand. Visit patriotfoods.com and click shop now today. That's patriotfoods.com and click shop now today.
HelpVet.net is a national help center helping the military community with all of your everyday needs. Whether you need a realtor, an attorney, health-related services, or information on retirement planning, financial resources, or more, our vast network of hand-picked qualified service providers are waiting to help you. With up-to-date military news and resources, you can find answers to all of your daily needs at HelpVet.net. HelpVet.net wants to thank you for your service, and may God continue to bless the U.S. of A.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum. This is the final formation for this hour on Frontlines of Freedom. We're continuing our conversation with Sean Sorby from Veterans for Smart Power. Sean, let's talk about power. I think the average person, if you mention power in any kind of way, they're going to think about gas prices and the Green New Deal and all that stuff. You guys must have a position on global warming and that sort of thing. Would you give us some insights?
Yeah, well, we at USGLC, you know, our primary function, again, is to advocate for, you know, the international affairs budget and the programs that it funds. And, you know, some of those programs are designed to tackle the challenge of climate change. And, you know, there's some other words for that and some words for approaching the issue. But here is, I think, the main bottom line, as far as we're concerned, as far as the international community is concerned, is that, you know, climate change is a massive problem that affects both international and domestic security, both in the near and the long term. And maybe people don't think about it that way often, but this is going to take not only a whole of society approach here at home, but it's going to require real American leadership on the global stage to solve it and to shield Americans from the devastating effects of this crisis. And therefore, robust resources are needed to support diplomatic and development efforts worldwide to address and prevent the crisis because this is in our best economic and security interests. And, you know, if you look at polling, you know, I think most people agree that climate change is a thing that's happening. And, you know, if there's any disagreement between everyday people, not scientists, it's what is the cause of that climate change? You know, is it like the normal cycle on Earth over time? Is it primarily driven by human activity? And I'm sure a lot of your audience probably heard all these arguments and all the evidence that support the fact that climate change is being driven by human activity and is primarily a result of us, you know, putting carbon into the atmosphere and at the same time destroying carbon sinks on the Earth, such as rainforests and wetlands. But, you know, I'm not an expert on all this stuff. I don't want to spend too much time here debating the cause. You know, that's out there and there's not a lot I can add to the conversation. But what I do want to talk about is the reasons that folks like me, and frankly, those that are way smarter than me, think that the effects of climate change are a national security risk, and what is being done, what can be done, and why. And, you know, however, just so your listeners are clear on where I'm coming from, I do think it's probably valuable for me to state a few key facts about climate change that a large majority of the scientific community agrees to. And that's that gases like carbon dioxide and methane act as a greenhouse when they're in the atmosphere. The rate of carbon emissions are the highest they've been in 66 million years. And humans have only been on Earth for 200,000 years. And we've seen an extreme increase in these emissions in the last 100 years, coinciding with the Industrial Revolution. I mean, I don't think that's any shock. So if we assume that climate change is a thing that's happening, then we have to consider the threats that are presented by this phenomenon: rising seas, destruction of ecosystems, unpredictable and severe weather. All these things are related and overlapping, and they have a lot of implications for humans domestically and globally. And folks in our government, in our national security apparatus, in the business world, and in our diplomatic and development apparatus have been considering this, have been planning for it, and have put some plans out there that that need some resources. And I'm happy to go into to some of that if it pleases you.
No, we don't need to do that. Renewable energy is something that everybody's talking about too. There's no doubt in my mind that renewable energy is going to play a bigger and bigger role in the future. But it seems to me that the hardcore green people want it to be available now at a level it's not capable of doing. The science isn't there yet. It's not ready. Does that make sense to you, or do you have a position on that?
I certainly hear what you're saying, and I've heard that before. I mean, I am a guy who drives an electric car. You know, I ride a bicycle both for fun and for transportation sometimes, and I'm all behind that. I think anybody wants, if we could have it right now, you know, the technology that's going to be as clean as it can possibly be. And I think that the technology really is there. And I think it just requires a little bit more will, political will, to try to make investments that are going to push it over the edge and lead it to wide adoption. Now, I mean, I don't think that we're going to be able to just go off of fossil fuels tomorrow. I'm not so naive as to think that. It's cheap. It's easy to use. It's easy to carry around. You know, any sort of liquid petroleum products, they carry way more energy per pound than a lithium ion battery does, right? So I totally get that. But, you know, if you look at our Defense Department, they understand that we're not always going to be able to rely on fossil fuels. They're already developing technology, developing plans and strategies to try to address when in the future we won't have access to these fuels because they're either just gone or we're in some sort of a operational situation where we don't have easy access to them, and figuring out other ways that we can store energy and use it efficiently and not have to rely on a global market that is, you know, can be affected by things like what we're seeing right now in Ukraine, right? You know, even if we have all the gas that we want domestically, when those global prices go up, that's going to affect people here at home at the pump. It's going to affect our Department of Defense, which is the biggest consumer, of course, of fossil fuels in our government. So I think that the challenge is great, and I think it's been recognized, and I think that folks are trying to move in the right direction. And if you look at the global international development projects that we're doing to try to shore up those very at-risk communities around the world where we have development projects that are setting up microgrids, they're setting up renewable programs in these countries, whether that be solar programs, wind, hydroelectric, whatever the case may be, because that's the energy that's going to be available to those folks rather than trying to go and drill a well that they're not going to have access to or be able to operate. So when folks are looking to the future around the world, it's the renewables that people are working on. And frankly, I think when you look at, you know, corporations domestically here, they understand that's coming too, and they're working on that technology and moving towards it as well. Is it fully available now? Can we switch over to it immediately? No, that's not realistic, but it's certainly worth putting some resources behind and trying to plan for the future.
That sounds like a really good summary of the situation, and I appreciate that. Sean, how can listeners who want to plug into or learn more about Veterans for Smart Power or your parent group, how can they plug in?
If you want to go to usglc.org, that is our main website. And there you can learn more about these and other topics that are related to America's leadership role in the world. What's going on now? What are the things that we're doing? What are the things that we need to be doing? And what's it going to take to get us there? We are an organization that is, we're really nationwide, but we're super active in over 30 states around the country. So many of them, we have advisory committees that are totally bipartisan groups. You'll see a lot of names in there from your community that you might recognize. You might have some friends who are already part of the organization. And to be clear, the only thing that you need to be a member of Veterans for Smart Power is to be a veteran who's concerned about what it is that we're doing around the world. And much like you, Denny, I see it as my role to help provide a platform for veterans to talk about their unique experiences and bring their unique perspective to bear on an issue that, again, a lot of Americans don't know a lot about. And I would say that a lot of the people that I work with, we kind of view it as a continuation of our duty to educate our fellow countrymen on these issues that maybe they haven't been exposed to. And we have, and we get to use that wisdom and experience that we've gained in the military to help raise awareness about an issue that folks don't give a lot of attention to, but maybe they should pay more attention to.
Sean, thank you. Thanks for taking time to join us today. Thank you for your service to our nation. It was fun talking.
Thanks to you, Danny. Really appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, and keep doing what you're doing. I appreciate it.
I really enjoyed that interview with Sean. I disagree with him on global warming and those issues, but our goal in this show is to think about things, not tell you how to think. Well, this concludes the first hour of the show. We'll start the second hour talking with Elliot Shodoff of the Israeli Defense Force. Then Valerie Leffler will discuss how Phoenix gives rights to vets. Of course, we'll conclude with our weekly mailbag, military history, and our Armed America Report. Troops, I'm not fond of pain, and I absolutely won't use addicting products. That's why I can recommend Day 3 Creation products if you're in pain. Use the code FREEDOM when you order at day3creation.com and save 20%. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for jumping jacks. Do 50 good ones. Then grab some protein, rehydrate with water, and finally, put a big smile on your proud-to-be-an-American face and send me your thoughts by email or on Facebook.